Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. Sixième épisode, conférence de Dominique Lédet, Democratic Struggles from Below and the Institutions of Constitutional Representative Democracy.
So first of all, I would like to thank Jocelyn McClure and Dimitri for having invited me to this conference. It is a great pleasure for me to be here. It's a great honor also to be there. I know this is not a competition, but I will simply say that it was a great pleasure to be introduced to political philosophy by Professor Tully when I was an undergraduate at McGill a long, long time ago, and that the best memory ever that I will always keep and cherish is the honor seminar that I followed with Jim in the very early 80s, I will leave it at that, on power. So thank you very much to have invited me here. So Charles Taylor's talk yesterday was entitled The Crisis of Democracy. And as we have heard, that crisis is very much the crisis of representative or party democracy. And this sense of a crisis or a deep malaise of things not going right is also at the heart of my own preoccupations when reading the two volumes of Public Philosophy in the UK in preparation for this conference. What can we learn by reading Tully? What might be helpful in confronting this crisis? What tools can we find in his thought? So there are four ideas that come out particularly strongly in his work, and I will go through them and make a few comments. The first one is that we should not look at constitutional representative democracy as the regulative universal ideal of democracy. On the contrary, by replacing the birth of representative government within the history of the modern constitutional state, Tully wants us to realize that the development of modern democratic government, though it is often described, and I quote, as freeing people from pre-modern forms of subjection and bringing democratic citizenship to them, has also meant the dispossession of people from access to political power through pre-existing forms of citizenship and the channeling of democratic citizenship into participation in the official public sphere of modern representative government. This is true within Europe and, of course, even truer in the non-Western world in which those representative institutions were forcibly exported. So the first thing is we should forget about looking at representative government as a sort of universal regulative ideal. Indeed, the way in which Tully associates the civil mode of citizenship to representative democracy and opposes it to what he calls the civic mode is another way to make this critical point. The civil mode of citizenship pertains to the juridical conception of citizenship as a status that upholds the priority of civil liberties. On this mode, the raison d'être of political liberties or democratic liberties, so the right to vote, to join a party, to manifest, is to protect the private autonomy of individuals. Democratic rights cannot be extended and exercised in the private sphere, for instance, in the workplace, in order to protect civil liberties. So this is what, as Robin has said, this is what Tully calls low-intensity or restricted democracy, and that he opposes to the civic mode that refers to the diversity of situated practices and activities in the West and the Northwest. So that's the first idea. The second idea is that Tully follows in the footsteps of many contemporary theorists in radically decentering representative democracy and its institutions. So, for instance, so the first idea in this point is the spread of governmentality, governance without government. As he tells us, the functions of government are not located in or controlled by a set of traditional representative institutions and their constitutional framework. There are as many practices of governments as there are systems or practices of action, coordination across the public, private, and voluntary spheres, and in which individuals and groups have the rights to have a say over the way their conduct is governed. The second point is, of course, the dispersion of governments, both within the states through devolution, federalization, etc., and above the state, through supranational and global governance. The third idea is that though representative democracy and its mode of citizenship is the object of strong criticism and deflation, there is no suggestion, that it should be overturned. So there's this very radical criticism of representative democracy, but it is there. It is now part of our traditions and practices, and we do actually need it. From time to time, Tully uses the expression well-ordered constitutional democracy. So there is such a possibility as a well-ordered constitutional democracy. And what does a well-ordered constitutional democracy do is that it opens many ways of participation to citizens. It opens, citizens can participate both directly and indirectly in political dialogues, directly in public sphere, referendums, political parties, elections, etc., and indirectly through relations of critical trust with elected representative courts, etc. So a well-ordered constitutional democracy is something that opens up different ways of participating that are both official and non-official and makes it all possible. So a well-ordered constitutional democracy is something that we should strive for, since it opens up, makes available a framework in which citizens can participate in many different ways. Elsewhere, Tully also reminds us that civic dialogues in which citizens or minorities struggle for recognition should not be elevated to the status of a new solution to all problems of recognition. And so he wants to remind us that in some circumstances, it must be possible for minorities to appeal to institutions like courts or parliaments when the existing asymmetries of power in those dialogues influence the result. And so it is, so institutions of representative democracy, we should be able to think about them as possible resources and not simply as obstacles to the civic actions of citizens. But of course, and that's the fourth point, our institutions work pretty badly. So it's not very often that they do appear as resources rather than obstacles. A very interesting point that Tully makes here is that we hear very often today that the problems of representative democracy are linked to political globalization, that have weakened the nation state, and this is why governments are not able to do what citizens expect of them. You know, the welfare state is going down the drain, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the very important, I think, remark that Tully makes is that, and here I will quote him, is that many of the problems that ail democracies are not new and cannot be blamed as the consequences of globalization. And here I just want to make a quote that seems to me very important. The widespread dissatisfaction with and cynicism towards the potency of representative government does not seem to be the effect of globalization. Rather, it appears to be caused by the traditional faults in the practices of modern representative government themselves. The high cost of running for office, the failure to represent women adequately and to represent a growing cultural diversity of the electorate, the inequities of the first-past-the-post system of elections, the importance of backbenchers and parliamentary committees as decision-making power becomes concentrated in tiny elites, all those things. Such have been well documented by countless studies and royal commission. So let's hold on to that key sentence, traditional faults in the practices of modern representative government themselves, in the practices of modern representative government themselves. Sort of the fourth idea then is to turn to practice. Tully, in his illuminating reading of Hannah Arendt, reminds us that our first object of interest should be the activity of politics itself rather than the framework in which those practices take place. So instead of trying to conceive of the perfect blueprint that we then try to apply, we have to look at those practices. And one of his comments on Benjamin Constant, La liberté des anciens comparée à celle des modernes, Tully commends Constant for having emphasized the importance of nurturing the liberties of the ancients as opposed to that of the moderns. But he criticizes Constant's suggestion that we should look towards the institutions of representative government and the legislators to initiate those practices. And he tells us that we should, to the contrary, we should turn towards the motley of practices by civic citizens that happen so everywhere else. So I want to keep this in mind and ask then the question, what can we make of these suggestions when confronting the traditional faults in the practices of modern representative government? So the first remark, I call that the poverty of theory. So the ills of representative democracy are not new, as Tully has reminded us. For instance, when we look at the decline of deliberation, as Tully mentions at one point, well, that decline has been going on since the end of 19th century. So it's not news to anyone. The problems of representativity are also not new. We have had countless commissions talking about that. The problem of party discipline also is an old problem. We all know about that. And yet, there's been an incapacity, in theory, to solve that problem. So normative democratic theory has had the tendency to simply get discouraged about parliamentary institutions and turn the and turn its interest towards, for instance, the public sphere or other institutions aside from parliamentary institutions. So we don't drop those institutions. They're there. We simply don't know what to do with them from the perspective of the theory. When we look at political science, so descriptive political science, what we see is, in a sense, a reaffirmation of the status quo. For instance, so if you read stuff in political science about the lack of or the poverty of parliamentary debates, what you see is a criticism of the naivety of people who actually get scandalized about that, about the about the state of those debates, as a lack of understanding of the necessity of party discipline in order to have party government. So the idea is that we need political parties to have party government, and we need party government in a parliamentary system to have a stable government. And so that's the reality, and people who understand that are simply naive. And then we do research, and we simply describe the necessity of the status quo. That's what we do. So there's been, in a sense, so that's what I call the poverty of theory, both on the normative side and on the descriptive side. So what does, what can Tully's injunction that we look towards practices teach us? Well, actually, if you look at actual practices in many representative democracy, then you start seeing that that there are ways of acting otherwise, and many more than you would suspect. And so, for instance, if you look at the parliament in the UK, you see that there are ways for MPs to express publicly dissent that do not involve voting against, for instance, the party. For instance, early day motions, that are motions that are signed by an MP and can be signed by many MPs to signal publicly dissent and get an interesting conversation going inside the party and inside parliament. And so where the strict party line gets not annihilated, because we do need political parties, but there is a déverrouillage of the debate. So instead of having one side against the other, you see something much more interesting and more complicated. We also see that voting against the party means many different things. And so there is this, at the level of theory, this very stark characterization of what it means. And when we look at the actual practice, we see that, in fact, the reality is much richer than what the theory signals. So in a sense, I think that looking at the actual practices in existing parliament may inspire the theory and may inspire a beginning of solution to some of those problems. So that's one way to go about it. A second great challenge of contemporary parliaments, so for those of you who have vague memories of Habermas, you will remember that parliaments ought to play an important role in being a kind of antichambre between the formal political system and what's going on in the public sphere. So they have to be what Habermas says, porous to what comes up from the what's happening in the public sphere. And one of the problem and one of the challenges of contemporary parliament is their difficulty of acting as interface between the administrative, between the government itself and the public sphere, and this incapacity. And what we see also is attempts by governments, by the executive, to use parliament and use certain institutions to legitimate its attempts to pretend having popular support. So, for instance, then we should remember Tully's injunction when criticizing Constant that we should not, that we should be wary of initiatives coming from the government to initiate democratic action. So I will give you an example, but also an example that I think we should reflect upon in order to see again what we can learn from the practice. This winter, this autumn, we saw the Quebec government trying to use parliamentary hearings during the Charter of over Bills 60 and the Charter of Values, so trying to use parliamentary hearings in order to legitimate its policy. And it's interesting to see the incredible number of briefs that were sent to the parliamentary committee, which in itself is interesting, that citizens wanted to use that venue in order to express their opinion over the charter. That's one thing. The second thing, it's interesting to see how the government tried to use that in order to push its own agenda. And one of its very smart attempts, which I didn't see coming, was to say, we will hear everyone who has presented a brief. We will hear in the order in which the brief the briefs were sent. I had thought that the government would select very few people to the hearings, and they did exactly the contrary. And so people were aghast at that. So it meant that, for instance, the Barreau du Québec was heard, next to the Association des Druides du Québec, and stuff like that. So there was absolutely no attempt at classifying the different interventions. But it's also interesting to see how groups reacted then to this attempt at controlling that prise de parole. And what did groups do? Well, Jocelyn knows very well. They decided to publish the briefs before being invited to present it officially to the committee in order to try to get the discussion going in the public, independently of what was going to happen in the hearing. So I think that here again is something interesting that we should reflect upon. So we have an attempt by the government to find legitimation in initiating some kind of participation from the public, and this is really top down. And then we see the way in which the public responds, trying to claim a certain form of autonomy from this attempt to control and legitimate from above the governmental policy. So I think that here again we see ways in which turning away from the poverty of theory and looking actually at practices might open up new pathways for our reflections. Thank you.